I want to send out a special thanks to the sponsors of today's show, William, Josie the Mountain Troll, and Panther. Thank you so much. We humbly and truly could not do this show without you.
Southern Bramble is a Patreon-supported podcast. If you would like to support the podcast and gain access to early, unedited video footage, listener questions, or be thanked by name, you can find us at patreon.com/southernbramble.
You're listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of crooked ways. I'm Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light.
And I'm graceful, delicate. They had to go. Baynex Bramble, Austin, that's my name. Marshall, how are you today?
I'm fine. It sounds like you're a little bitter. You got the Malibu Barbie.
Debbie's an icon.
Debbie is an icon. And you know what fucking sucks? That I, as an adult that I can see now, they would have totally embraced her.
I think so. Like, I she's mean, a murderess.
Like, he would have loved being attempted murdered for the rest of his life. And she would have enjoyed attempting to murder him constantly. Like, they literally were like, Debbie, we get it. We understand. We embrace you. And she's just like, no, I'm a bad person. They're like, no, we get it. We love that about you.
Yeah.
Poor Debbie. Yeah. They had you're it so coming. Right.
Yeah, you're so right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Anyway,
today we're here not to talk about iconic camp movie mistresses of the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Thank however, you, Addams Family Values.
I could talk about her all day. She's an icon.
Truly.
The all white. Debbie, that I could forgive. But pastels? get out of my house! Marshall, what are we talking about today? Looks like we have a lot to cover.
We do. And you know, some of it's going to go fly by, I think, because it's really talking points. But today we're going to be talking about grass-fed witchcraft, building your practice, your craft, around your literal space, your environment, your place on this planet Earth. Now, you actually are the one that came up with this topic. I think many of us are in a point in time now, especially as new practitioners, who feel like it all comes from books. Everything comes from books. And I feel like this episode is really great to kind of see how you could step away from the books and really start building with your local environment.
Well, to start, I think that going off of working or operating with, or not even just necessarily working with, but like doing things surrounding the spirits of your land, the spirits of place, like the immediate spirits that are around you. I think those things are very important. So many of the things that I get from, like if I buy something from a new magical practitioner, whether it's like a tool or something like that, the first thing that I'll do is usually bury that or integrate that into my own land somehow. And so the spirits of place, I think, are very important. And the way that this is conceived in so many different, you know, we talked a little bit about spirits of the home with Nay a few episodes ago. And then there's also, aside from house spirits, is also things like the Agathos Daimon, which is typically a spirit of home, but I think also can be a spirit of place as well, which is conceived as like a serpent or a snake that lives within the land. I don't think it always has to be that specific, but for my own like local area, mm-hmm. being able to go to the backwoods and, you know, doing offerings, particularly at the stations of the sun, that's the equinox and the solstices, is very important, to kind of appease those spirits and remind them and feed them and like be like, hey, I'm here and I do magic on this land. And it can get very vast. For me, there is this chimeric aspect to the spirit of place, where it's made up of like the dead, the sorcerous magic that's there, the plants, the trees, the minerals, and also living in Florida, like there's, this aspect where honoring the indigenous people who were here on this land can also be very important. And so being aware of all those things. Do you do any like spirit of place in your city or things like that?
Oh no, absolutely. And I think I really want to make sure that if you've never listened to this up to our podcast before, it's important to understand that as animists, when we're talking about spirits, we're not just talking about a bunch of ghosts. And I think I remember talking with someone recently about working with spirits, and they were like, "Oh, I don't believe in ghosts." And I was like, "Oh, sweetie, no, like," and I wanted to make sure, like, when we talk about like the spirit of place, spirit of the home, a lot of times I think some people sometimes misinterpret that as like working with dead people. And I think that this is a really great time to kind of talk about what it means when we say the words like spirit of place. There's a really common term that we use, genius loci or genius loci, depending on how you say it. I actually have no idea which one's the correct term. I've talked to so many different people and no one can give me the 100%. I'm sure it has something to do with dialect, possibly. But a genius loci is the guardian spirit of a place, the special atmosphere of a particular place. And so for me, living in a great city, I would say that the genius loci would look a little different from it might be look living like where you live in a more like woodsy area of Florida. If someone was over in New England, which had a very different history, a very different background, a very different region of space, it would also contribute to a completely different type of land spirit or genius loci, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, for sure. And the way that cities also have these like amalgams of different like different spirits that can really take on the shape and not even just spirits themselves, but also like boroughs and neighborhoods and districts and so all those things can be really interesting. You can feel that even when you just like it's like, oh, you're in one part of a town and you walk like a block up and you're in a completely different part and it looks different. And all these things also play into it, like finances and class and things like that. So that definitely changes things. I've always compared the nature of LA to being very vi vampiric. Just because
Oh,
it feels very vampiric.
absolutely. It's very vampiric. It's very like there's something a little predatory about, in my opinion, like the spirit of LA. There's this aspect of absolute beauty and sunshine and gloriousness and glamorousness. But there is like this super seedy underbelly of it as well. There's the predatory nature of the actual industry. There's the cost of living. There's the homelessness that is extremely. Mind you, it sounds like we're talking about like, oh, well, this is just the economy of a city. What do you think makes up the spirit? Like all of these things come together to create what the spirit of that place is.
They definitely these things are not exclusive of each other. They're very much so impactful by each other. So yeah, I think that and these places in particular too, like sometimes they'll be attached to certain local features, which we'll talk about later. Sometimes they're embedded in particular bodies of water. Sometimes they're anthropomorphized. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're animals. Sometimes they're like I said, chimeric. Sometimes they're infernal or wild looking. So yeah, I think that it can appear in many different ways and but it's very interesting to me, and I think that for me personally, like making sure that they're fed at 4 times a year is very important. It's usually pretty small, like it's nothing like grand or anything like that.
Just like a little kibble.
Yeah, a little kibble, some bread, some bread and some wine, and that's about it. But or like on the winter solstice, usually I'll take in my pumpkins and I'll smash them. and like I'll feed them that. Scraps are good, I find, like composty materials almost, personally. But you know, if you live in a city, that might not be like your girl's flavor. You know, she might like something a little nicer, something a little more
Shiny.
candles, shiny candles, apples, smell goods, of course. So yeah, for me to introduce these things, especially because they do get worked a lot in my witchcraft, it's like, yeah, it's important for them to be appeased.
There's a couple of notes here I have that I always think of. One of the things that I kind of associate the concept of the witch's devil with the genius loci or spirit of place. And that's not the same idea that I think everyone takes on. I think there's a range of space that people kind of insert him or them in. It is really interesting, though, to kind of see those two come together in a practice. I know I myself sometimes, because I see the witch's devil as the, or the man in black as like a spirit of physicality, it actually starts to actually, it fits into my practice as being part of the spirit of place. Also, he's super queer, at least in my little zone of the area, because I live in, like, I've talked about this before. I live in the gayborhood. There's an entire history of struggle and pride and life and death here. So, there is a level of sensuality and struggle and freedom that I can feel when I experience life working with the spirit of place where I live.
Yeah, for sure. There's everything that can make up these things and perfumes, for lack of a better term, their virtues and their energy. Speaking of, let's oh, sorry, there's one more thing that you but we kind of glossed over, and that's the you said the everyone of a tribe of people. What do you mean by that?
So I was writing to some list of things that we kind of think of when you think of spirits of place. So sometimes the spirit of place, like a literal landmark, sometimes it's the spirit of a tribe of people. And I want to be very general when I say tribe. I'm not talking about specifically indigenous people to America, but I'm talking about a collection of people who are part of a culture through history, have worked with continuous spirits. A lot of ATRs over here in the United States, that's African religious traditions, they work with sets of spirits. That are still local to them because they have brought them with their culture. And I think that that's something that I think should be included and discussed. Now, that's one I'm not going to get too into because I don't follow ATRs and I don't want to be a spokesman for it. But like, then there's also concepts of the way in which you also see smaller groups of people when it comes to like Mormonism. When you talk about the way in which a collective of people in a really specifically large body of place, mostly Utah, have settled and created an entire culture of existence. So when you go to Utah, there are so many Mormons, part of that culture, that are part of the legislative system. They have actually legislated a lot of their beliefs into laws of the state of Utah. So like they don't drink alcohol, right? So one of the things to if you don't know, if you've never been to Utah, you cannot get a drink after a certain time on certain days. You can't have more than one. And they literally have to measure. There's no such thing as a double shot. It is so hard to get drunk in Utah, at least if you're going out. And that's just an example I'm trying to give when we think of bodies of people who build cultures that will have spirits attached to them.
Another thing that we can talk about is features of the land. And for this, it's like these can be several different things. They don't have to necessarily have like a landmark sign next to them. In particular, a lot of the times there'll be particular trees, wells, rivers, bridges. It doesn't have to be a natural feature. It can obviously be houses, specifically like haunted houses or caves. There's in my local area, there's a type of well, or I'm sorry, a type of bridge that's very famous for supposedly having this legend around it That probably is untrue, but this legend that it was cursed by a local tribe during the Seminole War. And this bridge became very famous for its drownings. And while the legend is disputed, I will say that I've been to the bridge. The bridge actually isn't standing anymore. But I've been to where the bridge was, and it is definitely a place that has a spirit in it that I find is very hungry and is very welcoming to bring people in to swallow them under the waters. So it's a very interesting place. Other than that, there's also, of course, trees that can be pacted with particular lightning struck trees or trees that are in the centers of glades, large trees that like kind of stand out. Funny enough, we also have like this, Florida has a lot of like eagle conservation, and so we do a lot of the structures that are like cell phone towers, but they're meant to look like pine trees, so eagles will nest in them, and they stick out. Like all the trees, and it's like, oh, here's this one very particular, weirdly looking large tree. And I'm not saying that those things can be worked, but that's where what it made me think of is like the large tree that you see, that kind of towers over everybody. And a lot of the times, people will pact with these trees and tie ribbons to them or put petitions in them.
I've seen like the wishing trees that sometimes are really famous in specific places.
I also have a wishing tree by me. It's not that far. I don't necessarily know if it's a wishing tree. They probably, I think they might call it like something like a fairy tree or something like that, and it
Sure.
isn't, but a lot of people will like hang things in it. I think it's a memorial. But they'll hang spoons and stuff, and it's heavily decorated.
I
It's
love
very
a good
beautiful,
spoon.
actually. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It's very decorated, it's very shiny, very gorgeous. And this also is like a place to harbor power, especially as like this memorialized aspect to it. There's this like necromantic quality where the dead can be leveraged, as well as the tree being propitiated to do magic in your favor. So I think those things are really interesting. Wells, obviously, you could think of like the Levee Fountain, people wishing at the Levee Fountain, or even less decorated. There are a lot of well cults in like all over Europe where the spirits of the well, or sometimes the ladies of the well, the nymphs in the wells will be propitiated as well to make magic happen. So I don't have very many wells around here. I have a lot more beaches and oceans, and the wells that we have are underground, and they give us plumbing. But yeah, what about you, Marshall? Any magic wells?
I don't know of any particular magic wells very specifically where I live, but it is very interesting because I've been thinking a lot about, and we were talking about this before. I think a lot of times when practitioners start building a practice, it starts with books. It starts with getting a lot of one-on-one books, how-to books, how to start building your practice. And you start reading all these 101 and 101.5 books till you get to the point that you're like, I need something more. I need something more advanced. And I think that there is a lack of 201 books, 301 books, if you want to call them that, because a lot of times by that point in time, you're really not getting it out of a book anymore. You're getting it more so out of your experience, your spirit interactions. So like that is going to involve getting out there on your own land. So when I think of like really major famous, not just landmarks, but like like as you said, natural places, it makes me think of like people that live over in the over like Michigan or Chicago or some of those areas by the Great Lakes. They would have a witch or a cultist or a practitioner in that area might be working a little bit more with the spirit of those Great Lakes when it comes to contracts, when it comes to water gathering, when it comes to conservation. It's about building a relationship so you can have this pull and take of power when it comes to building a place of energy source for your practice. When I think of Florida, of course I think of the beaches. I think that's so true. And Texas, it's very interesting. It's one of the largest states in the United States, and so it actually is the only state, from what I understand, if I remember correctly from my geography class, has all four regions. I know, right? So it has like plains and all the other three regions. I can't remember what they are. But like where I live, funny enough, I live at a crossroads. I've talked about this before. I have like an almost 200-year-old tree at the corner of where I live. And so like that's something that I venerate and I think about and I include in my practice as a major source. It's a large oak, so I gather acorns for it for specific reasons. But it's right at the crossroads. It literally has a canopy that reaches over it. So a lot of times when I am working in my own personal altar in my space, I am kind of casting my awareness out to that crossroads area and bringing it into my personal space. It's funny when you talk about wells, because historically, you know, there are cursing wells. I don't know of many cursing wells over here in the United States, but I remember reading about a few different ones in history over in Europe. They found, you know, cursed tablets at the bottom of them. Like literally, it was a lead tablet that you would inscribe a curse on someone, and then you would toss it into the cursing well. Some of these got so popular they had to close them up. But imagine in the modern day, if you live in a place that is near one of those cursing wells, like you would have the opportunity to tap into that magic, tap into that power. And it's interesting because I'm saying all of these things, understanding that they are individualized depending on where you are on the earth. And I think, and maybe this is just me, this is an opinion, this is a little tea on my opinion, right? I'm spilling here for a sec. I think a lot of times, a lot of practitioners look for something that is more universal than more personal, because then they have the opportunity to write it down and share it with other people. But I mean, this is, I think, really rampant on the internet. The way in which you want to reproduce something that is aesthetic and shareable. And if it's too personalized, it may not be able to recreate it. It may not be able to recreate it by someone else. So it's not sellable. It's not monetizing. It's not something that you can say, look what I have to offer. You could have this too. And I think sometimes we don't get as personal with our own land spirits because we're not thinking about our spirituality as an individual relationship as much as we are thinking about how we're going to show other people it. Is that,
That's fair.
you ever, you're, have you seen that? I feel like I've seen that a little before. I even thought when writing about some of my own interactions, because I write a diary, I keep a diary, and I keep thinking like, this is going to show something that if someone were to read years from now or somewhere else, it's not like a spell and a grimoire that they could repeat because they don't have that relationship. That's not the location they are. And I think many of us seem to think that it needs to be generalized, it needs to be universal for it to be reproduced. Because as scientists, a lot of scientists, when it comes to the scientific method, it's things need to be peer reviewed. Not all witchcraft can be peer reviewed. And I think sometimes if it can't be peer reviewed, people tend to shy away from it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of times there's a reproductive quality to it. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse.
Yeah, sure. It goes
There
both
is,
ways.
yeah, for sure. There's certainly a benefit to having people who you trust to like test your work and see how it works out for you. I love sending things to like close friends and being like, oh, will you test this thing out for me? But there is also something too. I mean, with local environment or even things that are cultural or inherently like part of a place, it is very like how it's complicated, especially, and this goes into why do we work with spirits of somewhere else if it's a local spirit, right? And moving it all the way across America into our own backyards. I
We do that
say
with
that
some
with like
things.
yeah, and I say that with trepidation as like I'm like it happens anyways. I mean, and
It
globalism
does.
is a thing, and it can be really great at times, right? So it's complicated. But yeah.
Well, I have some really fun like landmarks here because this really kind of goes around the world. And I want to kind of point these out because most of these people will not think of as witchcraft related. But what we're trying to do, I think, with this episode, when it comes to grass-fed witchcraft, that means it's homegrown. That means you're looking to your local spirits. That means you're building a relationship with your local spirits. So if you happen to live, say, I don't know, over in Egypt, and you're practicing witchcraft, you might be much more interested in the spirits or the history of the Great Pyramids. You might be more interested into understanding working with the energy that is from the history of the Sphinx. You might be more interested, I know some people who have been really interested in like researching the heads on Easter Island. Those famous monuments that when they were dug, they realized they're not just heads. They're literally full bodies all the way underground. And it's going to have a lot of history. It's going to have an entire background. Over in the US, if you live over in New York, I know people are not going to associate this with witchcraft, but the Statue of Liberty, like there you have a massive idol in the middle of your ocean over in New York by Manhattan that has a long-standing history, a struggle to create. It's made of the conductive copper. It's a sim it's well, it's supposed to be a symbol of freedom. It's supposed to be, give me your tired, give me your poor, give me your needy. If you're in New York, or if you're in the, I would want to say probably like New Englandish area, trying to work with the spirit of the Statue of Liberty, I mean, that covers the oppressed, that covers the needy, that covers those who are searching to rise themselves out of marginalization. You know what I mean?
The Statue of Liberty, I actually recently went for like the first time. I've been to New York a lot in my life, but I've never gotten a chance to go to the Statue of Liberty. I've never cared, but excuse me. Oof. I went with my someone in my family recently, and I was like, hang on, I gotta like go off and I gotta collect some dirt from the Statue of Liberty and some dirt and some rose petals too from Ellis Island. So both of these things for using in liberation work and liberatory work. And also the selectiveness of liberation and the Statue of Liberty being this facade, honestly, of what freedom is, quote unquote, in this great country, the United States of America. Ellis Island was a very awful place. Honestly, it was not great. It was cruel in many aspects, right? So having this dirt that I think there's a bit of selectivity that needs to be had, and a carefulness, I think, with this materia that I have it sitting. I mean, it's sitting on my counter. It's been sitting there since like December, and I want to work with it, but I also want to make sure that it has like an efficaciousness, because if I'm using it for liberation and liberatory work, I want to make sure that it's also like, well, does that only work if there's class involved, if there's certain race aspects involved? And so I want to make sure that this dirt works very, efficaciously, and not just for some people, right? So there's an interesting aspect to that. But yeah, going and collecting Statue of Liberty dirt, and they have the whole thing fenced off, so it's like, not the whole thing, but like if you go to the Statue of Liberty, it's like there's a courtyard, or like this mound that the monument starts to be built on, and it's grass. And so like you can like scoop dirt from there, but it's like fenced off, so you kind of have to hop it. And of course there's like guards and stuff like that. So be careful. I will be the crazy person who is grabbing dirt from anywhere that I can find. Yeah.
What would you do with the dirt from the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
I don't know, because I don't know what the building's for.
I mean, not much of anything except for looking at it now. I'm almost more like stability. I'd probably use it for stability, the fact that it's been able to lean for that
Yeah,
many years and not fall
that's
over.
fair.
I mean,
Yeah.
imagine all those, imagine the egregore created by literally all those pictures of people pretending to hold up the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Who knows?
I've been there. I've been there and watched the field of people taking pictures of themselves, pretending to hold it up.
Iconic moments.
Truly.
I'm like, I don't know, what would I use? I'd use it as a means to conjure Isaac Newton, so we can learn better alchemy together. I don't know. Just kidding. He never went there. But yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what the I don't even know why the Leaning Tower of Pisa is actually there. Like, I don't have any idea what it's there for. I just know what it is.
There's a couple fun other monuments here. Like there's the Blarney Stone over in Ireland, which if you kiss it, gives you the gift of the gab. And you have to sometimes help, from what I understand, like it's not always easy to get. It's not really like that super easy to get to. Like sometimes you have to have someone help you. Is that, have you ever seen it before?
No.
I actually don't need to kiss it because I should probably shut up more often.
I'm like, I don't need that, Marshall. I'm on a journey of like learning to hold my tongue more.
In Texas, over in the US, you know, we have these major monuments like Plymouth Rock, the Liberty Bell, the Grand Canyon, the Hoover Dam. Imagine if you were looking to really find a history of power, like a power source in Nevada, and you went over to the Hoover Dam, like the history of building, like we had a whole tour of that years ago. And the deaths that went into creating that, the people that died in the process of building that dam, the power behind it, the structure, the electricity it provides for an entire city of people. There's so much into the animus of this dam. In Texas, we have the McDonald Observatory. It's over near Marfa. If you ever seen that like random Prada store in the middle of the desert, that's over in Marfa, Texas. It's like a It's actually an art installation. It's not really a store. But there's the McDonald Observatory, and people will travel from all over the state or even out of state to go see these major celestial events. And they'll drive into this area, and then people will camp out in this way, really, really open area by the observatory, because in Texas, it's one of the most clear places, I think, in the southern part of the United States to see so much of the sky, so much of the space, the Milky Way, planets, and like I said, major celestial events. So I've known people who will travel there for a very specific spellcraft they're doing, rituals they want to take on, whether that's spiritual or just personal. People really will really go out of their way to drive all the way out there so they can work with the spirit of that place and then also be a part of these major celestial events.
You got good starlight.
That's rad. That's rad. As we spoke about crossroads before, we spoke about dirt. One of the things that I wrote about in my book was crossroads nails. I feel like growing up, I saw a lot of things about coffin nails, about train nail, you know,
Railroad spikes.
railroad spikes. That's right. And I totally recognize the history of that. But nowadays, if you want a coffin nail or a railroad spike, you pretty much have to buy one from a procurer who is supplying it for you. A lot of times it's at an occult shop. It's a someone online. It's not something you are going out and gathering from the natural world. And for me, I like to kind of focus a little bit more on, obviously nails aren't really coming from the natural world. But if you ever go to a crossroads and you see huge, you know, columns holding up electro lines, telephone lines, and you look, there will be old, rusty nails nailed in there that have been there for who knows how many years, how many decades, staples, nails, screws that have had garage sales, missing pets, open houses, politician signs, business signs. So many people have come and crossed that crossroad and nailed something on there and then left behind this resting item that is taking on space, time, energy. So I will go out there and collect them at certain times. So like crossroads nails gathered on the dark moon might carry a different virtue than crossroads nails gathered on the full moon. And I might use those in certain spellcraft. I might work with them in certain protection charms or warding charms or crossing or uncrossing charms.
Can I ask why people don't, why don't people go get their railroad spikes from the railroad?
Well, I mean, if everyone took all the railroad spikes out of the railroad, I don't think there's anything to hold the railroad down.
But they fall out. That's the thing. They fall off. That's where people go get them from. They like them.
Gotcha. Okay, good, good, good. That's good to know.
Because I was gonna say I go pick mine up from an undisclosed location because it's in a city and I don't want people to go find them. Because it is an old railroad. If somebody was like, "Oh, it's because like the railroad, it has like been modernized somehow and we don't hold it in place with those like the railroad spikes," I'd be like, oh, "Okay, that makes sense." But like I go get these railroad spikes from. But that fair.
I mean,
Okay.
it'll, I mean,
Thank
we're,
you.
depending on where you live, like, I do not live in a place where we have trains that are for anything other than basically cargo.
Texas really, I yeah, same. Same. But Texas really said, yeah, let's build a city around the automobile.
Oh, hardcore automobile industry te is Texas. It's like, public transportation is abysmal here. Let's talk about the local dead.
Yeah, for sure. This one is really important to me in particular. Well, I mean, I think it's important to everybody, right? So talking about the chimeric virtue of the spirit of place, the local dead make up that. I think it was Matthew Venus who was talking about. He had asked somebody he recently. He was like, "Do you honor not just your ancestors that you can name, not even just ancestors that you can, but also like, do you honor the prehistoric ancestors and like people who come like way, way, way before you?" And I thought that was a very interesting thing. You know, here at a very special place to my and many people's hearts, the Mound House, which is a shell mound in Fort Myers, Florida. It's very interesting. You go and it's like there's a house there and there's history. This is a very, very old place. It is a Colusa burial ground, that's in Fort Myers. But there's, because of some excavation that happened, I don't remember if it was like archaeological or if it was like personal, because there were people who did eventually build on the mound and now it's a museum. But like you can go down into the mound and it's like a little chamber and you can see the layers and layers and layers of shell and rock from thousands of years that have been built up. And it's like you have to think that this is like how many years this has been just to be here in this moment. And there's so many people who have been buried here. The Clusa would bury their dead under the mounds, and also I believe, if I remember correctly, I'm not a Clusa expert, although I have a friend who knows quite a bit about their burial practices. They would bury their family members under their homes. And like we had talked about on the episode with Nay, also these two, sometimes they get charged as being the spirits of the home, right? So, but yeah, it's really interesting to like see these like layers and layers and layers and striations. And it's like it's stripes of like, this is 500 years old, this is 500,000 years old. You know, it's crazy. It's not that old, but yeah, it's wild. Other dead that are very important to obviously like local cemeteries and honoring the people who are there, and also leveraging them and putting them to work. And that's always very interesting, like local judges, local, and in that case I often find that like working with the immediate person who's very close to you is a lot easier than just going and finding somebody that you don't know, or calling some excuse me, some judge that you don't know. There's there's like some PGM spells where you call up a judge and like you sever a contract between like a god and somebody else, or like a spirit and somebody else. And the idea is that this judge is there to like officiate over everything. So
How
that's always very
legitimate.
interesting. Yeah, very, very much so. It's like I'm gonna call this ghost judge because you clearly know a lot about spirit contracts, to make sure that my spirit contract either goes through or doesn't. So I find that very interesting. Do you have a lot of local cemetery practices?
I have one local cemetery near. It's funny, actually. I have had several cemetery experiences, one growing up and one more recently. When I was growing up, I stumbled upon a cemetery that I didn't even know existed. It wasn't really on any map at the time. Mind you, what we had access to map-wise was mostly paper when I was that young. MapQuest was just beginning to be a thing when I was graduating high school. But I remember what I was like very in, like I said, very young starting witchcraft, and I would be very into tramsing through the forests or local like undeveloped zones or areas that were kind of between the neighborhoods in my local town. I lived in a suburb of a bigger city, so the suburb was developing, and it's developed. I mean, they have mowed down pretty much any forest or tree since I was a child. But when I was younger, there were still a lot of forested areas. And there was, I remember just sort of like going back behind my family neighborhood and going into like the trees and back behind a creek. And then all of a sudden, I saw this wrought iron gate that was totally overgrown. And then I kept going and I was like, oh my fuck, it's a whole cemetery. It's a secret cemetery behind my neighborhood growing up. And it was called like the Bullock Cemetery. Every single grave was from the 1800s. I think some of the early ones were even from the possibly late 700s, but most of them were 1800s. And I would gather if there were wild irises growing there like
Oh,
crazy.
that's gorgeous.
And
Yeah.
I remember gathering irises when I
I
was
can imagine
collecting.
this in my mind. I'm like, ah, oh, this
Lots
is
of
so
bulbs
beautiful.
every it was
Yeah.
beautiful. It was like a secret garden, sort of like,
Secret garden, secret cemetery.
yeah.
That sounds so pretty.
In the city that I live in now, and I took Olivia here there twice actually, and I've done some work there since, burying some few things. But there is a much there's two neighboring cemeteries right off of a major highway, and it's so crazy. One of them is very, very old, also graves all the way back to the 18 early 1800s. The other one, highly manicured. I mean, it feels like I'm walking into an AstroTurf set. It feels raw. I would never want to be buried there. Like the whole everything about it made me feel like it was sterile. Like no spirit would be welcome here. So I have a very, very different vibe going from one to the other. I also hate that they closed their gates and locked them at 4 p.m. I think that's dumb.
Where did I go just recently where the cemetery closed at like 3 p.m. and
Yeah,
I was
7 a.m. to 4 p.m. I'm
I'm
like,
like, what the fuck?
how am I ever gonna get dirt gathered at night?
Yeah, I mean, that is, here nor there, like you just jump the fence. And I'm like, okay, I get sundown, but like
Four. Yeah,
three
three.
or four in the afternoon. The one I just went to was like they closed at like 3 or 4 too. I
Wow.
don't re even remember where it was, but I was like, what the fuck?
In
Who
Florida, I
closes?
imagine.
Yeah. And I'm like, who closes this? Was it in Florida? I don't know. I've been a lot of places in the past couple of weeks.
She gets around.
Do I get around? Have you heard that about me?
Only from you. Do you know, there are some other really cool things when it comes to the local dead, I think people need to start thinking about a lot more of is like, who are the founders of your city? There are so
Yeah.
many major cities that literally were founded by a single family. Small cities, large cities. Look into that. Find out who they are. Do they have a monument? Is their house like immortalized? Like, is it a landmark? There is a street in Texas where I live, called Swiss Avenue, and it's got all of these old, beautiful, some mansions, some more like Victorian Queen Anne style homes. And this entire row is a historical district. A lot of towns will have these historical districts. You can go and find out who built them, how who lived there. You can find out so much about your city by looking into your historical districts.
A friend of mine recently got me, when I went to visit him, recently, he handed me a bunch of dirt, bags of dirt, from all these different places. One of them being, I can't even say who it is because it's so like people would be like, why do you have that?
Oh.
But it's very interesting. And I'm like, ugh, yes, get you friends who get you bags of dirt, or other weird little trinkets from all around their places. But I think,
Is this from the Manson compound?
no, but you're like kind of on the money.
I
Like
knew it.
you're headed in the right direction. It's kind of like, if I said it out loud, people would be like, that's gross that you have that. So I won't,
I just
but
want to put you on the spot.
I have reasons for having it.
Of course.
Anyways, even too, even things that are like less potentially malignant, obviously the places of church, the places of important crossroad sections, play banks, ballet schools, if you want to go very planetary with it, special gardens, art museums. There, of course, are like here we have the founders of the Shriner Circus, the Shriner College of the Arts. We also have in Miami, there's of course Gianni Versace's mansion, which you can sleep in now. So
Really,
have at that.
Airbnb?
Yeah, it's basically like an Airbnb, like it, I forget, it's like fucking like $100,000 for a couple of nights or something like that. But yeah, you can sleep in the Gianni Versace
It's expensive
mansion
nap.
now, right? But even getting, petitioning these places, of course, for if you're a burgeoning seamstress and you want help in within your prospects in the fashion industry. Of course, the artists, there's a ton of Baroque art in Florida, right? So even like swiping, if you can, some museums have like these like weird sensors where if you like cross over a certain part of the line, like an alarm sounds. But like at the Shriner Museum, they don't have those. It's like I really could just touch this fucking Caravaggio that's like, a couple hundred years old. I feel like I shouldn't be able to do that, but like I really could just like reach out and just swipe my little finger on it. They might have alarms. I've never tried it. But yeah, getting like collecting dust off these paintings or dust from these areas, I think go for it. It's very interesting and see what you can do with it. Aside from just is that local? Because I have to drive kind of far to get either of those. But like it's local enough. I go there enough,
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I think is really interesting because, like, Texas is a very large state. Is it
And you have
local?
to drive everybody everywhere.
Yeah. Is it local if I buy rattlesnake bones from Amarillo when I live 4 hours away? In my opinion, I'm still working with the spirits of my landscape. And I think that would be different if I was ordering snake bones from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Like the sourcing, sometimes it does matter. Other times it's like we don't care. It just, it's like, oh, we need snake bones and I don't care how you get them. And sometimes like we need these snake bones to be from a very particular place. So but for sure, it's like the local quality comes into aspect of it too. Does it have to be this very particular pine tree that I've built all these relationships with, that I've done all these pacts with, that I've given X amount of blood to? And that's a very special tree. And I don't just like go to that tree for, I go to that tree for personal reasons, and I usually don't like that's not within Baynex Bramble. Like I try to keep those two things kind of separate in that way. But also the sustainability aspect of it. If I'm selling, this tree rosin from this tree, it's like you'd have to have a lot of rosin. Yeah, so
Let's get into local plants.
yes, speaking of trees.
One of the things when it comes to literal grass-fed witchcraft, side note, I remember when I was younger and I was really into Wicca. My sister stole one of my books, and her neighborhood friend from across the street, she's 3 years younger than me, and across the street went outside to go gather grass because they were going to make a potion. And I was just like, why are you picking grass? And they were like, don't tell him, don't tell him. My sister was saying that to my friend, and she was like, don't tell him. And I was like, I'm literally in front of you. So I was just like, well, tell me what's going on. And her friend goes, we're going to make a potion. And I was just like,
From one of your
yeah.
books.
And I was just like, really? And my sister was just like, yeah. It's and she did. She was just like, I borrowed one of your books. And I was just, and she would steal my books all the time. She stole my gay erotica books when I was in high school. And I
Not gay
found,
erotica.
she did. She's that was her first exposure. I know, right? I had no idea until later. And I would find them in her room. And I'm like, these were hardcore gay
What's
erotica
your sister's
books.
first name?
Amanda.
Amanda, if you're listening to this, I would be so mad that your brother put you on blast like that. And I just want you to know we have a very high circulation of this podcast rate. So a lot of people are going to know now that
Millions,
million.
millions, and billions of people, 8 billion people,
8 billion whole people.
will know about Amanda's obsession with gay erotica as a teenager now. Anyways,
And Silver Raven Wolf.
I ended up helping them figure out how to make the potion they wanted to, and it did not involve grass. Speak as I was saying, grass-fed witchcraft, local land spirits. Yes, let's talk about plants. One of the things I think people need to think about when it comes to working with your local plants, what grows around you? What region are you in? We have a long history of plants we associate with witchcraft, like the obvious, like lavender, rosemary, rose petals, hyssop, but then, nettles. But then we also get into like the famous witching herbs, the mandrake, the belladonna, the thorn apple or datura, the henbane and hellebore. Not all of these grow freely, at least across the world in Texas. I know the mandrake and belladonna, they do not grow here, like, period. If you live in the United States, most likely when you go to a local occult shop and buy a mandrake, you're probably buying American mandrake, which isn't the same thing as Mandragora officinalis, which is the one in history that's been talked about over in Europe that carrying all these very specific historic properties and lore. So one of the things I like to think about is what actually grows in my neighborhood. When I take my dogs on a walk, what do I see around me? I see things like morning glory, dandelions, specific types of rose, specific types of grass. When it comes to, this is actually one of my favorites, what weeds actually grow where you live? Thistle, I call it mother's heart, but that's the folk name. What's the main one? Shepherd's purse is a really popular one right now, at least where I live. And there's those really cute little stalks with the tiny little seed pods that look like heart. They actually have a history of you being used in medicine for inflammation, and its folk name is mother's heart. So I use that herb for healing. But shepherd's purse doesn't grow everywhere. You might have to use a completely different herb for healing if you live somewhere else. If you live in a place where something else grows entirely in abundance, it doesn't grow in Texas at all. When I was over in New England, over in Salem, I got some yew that was growing over at the House of Seven Gables. Also, a historic place that I think if you're ever in Northeast or in the New England area, you should definitely go check out. Do you have any weeds or local things in your area that are super personal to you?
I do, yeah. I think it's really important to the occult herbalism, if you want to call it that, quote unquote. It's like we're so used to, and I trust me, I'm a perfumer, I make incense, I love me some oud, I love me some agarwood, I love me some saunders or some sandalwood, I love civet musk and ambrette seed and all those gorgeous things and like Turkish and Bulgarian rose oil and all of that. But there is also something very Gorgene about either A, cultivating your own environment by way of gardening, and that takes a very special skill, right? Or being able to identify plants that are around you. Some of my favorite plants is Malamware, or I'm trying to think of the botanical name. It's Texas bull nettle, essentially, and it
Oh,
grows in
yes.
these these fields, or for here it grows just about anywhere that the soil's really sandy, and it's like this, it's not a nettle, it's a completely different plant, but I mean the whole thing is just covered in spikes from the seed pods to the leaves to the undersides of the leaves, which is very uncommon, at least in my opinion. That I could be wrong, but like I don't see a lot of plants that it's like if you touch the underside, that's usually not protected in spikes. The stalk, the stem, the
With
flowers,
little yellow flowers.
little white, little yellow. So it
Okay.
depends on the species, but like
Look
the
that up.
genus. God, it's I know what it is. I just it's on the tip of my tongue, but it's like a really hard one to say too. It has a lot of the chucks sounds. But yeah, it's got these like little gorgeous white flowers. The seed pods are edible. It's kind of stinky, honestly. If you dry it
Oh.
out, it has a very particular smell. A gorgeous plant. Not as I mean mean-spirited as you would expect a very thorny plant to be, but also has to me personally like a sense of humor to it, which I find very gorgeous. Love her. Love her dearly. She grows about this time of year, actually. So she'll be popping up soon. We
I
have
would
tons of.
not want to run into this plant, at least
Yeah,
not with shorts on.
if you tread on it, or like, yeah, if you're wearing
Ooh.
shorts, it
It
looks scary, doesn't it?
is scary looking.
Yeah.
Y'all, if you're listening to this now and you are not driving, Google Texas bull nettle. I would definitely not want to have any skin nearby, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's a reason I always wear pants when I walk back there and closed-toed shoes. Because the spikes are almost like glass. Like they're not like woody, like a rose. They're like plasticky.
Yeah.
They're like needles. Other ones, of course, the palmetto, which is a kind of a stand-in for palm. For me, so there's a lot of that very Christian. I mean, they're related. They're part of the palm family, so it's not completely off. We do have palms around here as well, not the typical like Levant palms that are burned for Palm Sunday. They don't even burn them apparently anymore, as I've just found out. So that's a really beloved one. Of course, my rose bush, which I've grown, and people, know about the perfume work that I do with that particular rose, as well as some of the smaller, like weedier things, like lupine or lyre leaf sage, which grows around here. We have swamp roses apparently that I've never seen before, but camphor trees and sensitive pea and things like that, and all these gorgeous plants that are really quieter in terms of like there's not all this documentation that's written about them and their magic. But I think if you interact and engage with these plants, I think that can be leading to really powerful things.
No, I totally agree. And outside of just looking at to your local weeds that are growing in your backyard or your neighborhood, also think about like what's your state flower if you're in the United States? What is your state flower?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
When it comes to the way that our government has organized our states by category, by animal, by flower, there is an egregoric spirit behind that. There is a connection between a state flower and the local land spirits you're working with. So like in Texas, we have the state flower of the blue bonnets, but we also have like prairie fire, depending on where you live. So during the springtime, there are fields of absolutely beautiful blue bonnets and bright orange and pink looking prairie fire. I grew up reading, I want to say some stories that were like children's stories that had to do with some of the local indigenous tribes who had folklore surrounding these two flowers. I am now, as an adult, finding out that some of these are not based on reality and were just written by a white man and an artist and sold by a large traditional publishing house. But I mean, it's the same artist who did Stregonona, and it's hard not to love Stregonona at the same time. So I try not to take any of those children's storybooks as
Yeah,
real folklore. I'm talking about?
These are gorgeous.
Are there good blue
No, I
bonnets?
just well, no, the prairie fire.
Oh
That's
yeah.
pretty.
See, I grew up
Is
with
it
them being called.
paintbrush?
Yes, it was called something else before, but they have changed the name because I'll just be very, very clear. Growing up, they were always called Indian paintbrush, but that was not what tribes actually called this flower. That was something that white settlers gave to the name of this flower. So we have taken cues from local tribes who have let us know we don't appreciate it being called that. We never called it that. We called it something along the lines of prairie fire. So
Castilleja cremosa.
it's stunning. And
We
so if
have a
gathering and
type of
making
paintbrush.
offerings of this. Well, actually, you can't gather bluebonnets. They're a Texas state flower. You can't cut them. You can't pick them. But it is a major tradition in Texas for people to take their spring or Easter photos in a field of bluebonnets.
Gorgina, absolutely.
Plants you buy versus plants you grow. I think that this is a very nuanced topic because do I think that there's anything wrong with buying plants from anywhere in the world? Absolutely not. You do what you want to do. You patronize your local occult shops that sell herbs. You buy from growers online. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I do it myself. But I will say there is something to using your local plants. There's something, in my opinion, to using plants from your own garden that you've built a relationship with. There's something to working with the spirit of the morning glory flowers that I grow on my patio that I sing to while I water them every day through the summer. I think that there's a level of relationship that they work with me a little bit more personal, if that makes sense. They might be a little bit more attuned to my own energy, to my character, to my wants and my desires. What do you think about
Yeah,
that?
for sure. I think there's like something beneficial. It's like people oftentimes can find mugwort in a occult shop, or you can buy it online or get it in your next Sephora witchcraft kit or whatever. But I think like, and those are all great. Trust, like I love, well, maybe not the Sephora one, but like I love being able to utilize and incorporate dried herbs. They're very important. But like, do you also are we able to identify these plants and being able to like I do know what mugwort looks like in when it's not dried, cut, and sifted and then put into a plastic bag and sold for me for $2.99 for a 2 ounce. You know, mugwort's an easy one anyways, because it's like it stands out.
It
Like
does.
it's very and wormwood too is like it's silver. Like it's like this plant is a big white plant in the middle of a very brown field.
And if you
And it.
need, if you have an iPhone, you can download the Picture This app. It's amazing. I had no idea. I picture this and I was like, what does that do with plants? Oh, literally, it's for plants. You literally take a picture of it and it identifies it within a list of like thousands upon thousands of other plants.
Yeah, I really like it. I don't think that I know some people are like, oh, well, that can lead to inaccuracy. I don't think it's. For me personally, like I don't think it's ever been wrong.
No, I used to have another one called PlantNet that was wrong all the time, but Picture
Yeah.
This has never been wrong once.
Yeah, it's like it's really, I mean, I'm like, damn, okay.
It's using
It's
some
very,
sophisticated markers.
yeah, for sure. And I think it's a lot of it's ex user experience generated, because you can
Yeah.
upload those pictures to their database. It's really cool. It's really cool stuff. I mean, maybe it's been wrong like one time for me, if I'm thinking about it really hard, but
So check
yeah.
out Picture This.
Picture this. It's free.
Let's get into some local folklore because I think that this is a great way to close out the episode. When we talk about, like when we talk about a folkloric witch or the bardic tradition or thinking and talking about folklore stories, oral tales that are passed down over campfires. Like these are things that have influenced us, that have shared tales and ideas. about what we think witchcraft is, about what the devil does, about the dangers of being too greedy, about the dangers of not putting in the work for something you earn. Like, there are so many stories all over the world that we now know as Grimm's fairy tales, or turned into Disney movies, or have a history of being so local and small that they really didn't make it out of their own individualized village. In the United States, this is actually kind of something cool. In America, tall tales were invented, and that term comes from the 1800s that was created from a movement in the US. And it's really, really fascinating. A key part of American folk literature are tall tales. They're believed to have started from the bragging contests that came through American frontiersmen when they would start gathering around campfires. They would talk about the things that they would face in the movement west. Now, that of course had its own issues that I think are kind of obvious, but that's not what we're talking about today. Most tall tales come from the 1800s when courageous explorers had exciting adventures on their way into the Wild West. As they moved out, they would supposedly encounter creatures, beings, things, experiences, and kind of exaggerate them to kind of one up each other when they'd get back together, when they'd meet one another. And these stories were passed down over time. And to this day, I think there's a movie called Big Fish that I really, really love. Have you ever seen that one? A
I
Helena Bonham.
haven't, but I know what you're talking about.
Yes. It's great because it's literally a movie about tall tales. And I won't give too many spoilers away, but you kind of get to a point in the end when some of these tall tales are proven to be true, but they've just had a little bit added to them. But that's also what made the story so fun, so retellable, if you will. And many of the American pieces of folklore that we have today are kind of based in the concept of tall tales.
Love to see it. Then I'm thinking, like, isn't all legend tall tale? I
Well,
mean,
I mean, technically, if you want to superimpose it upon things before that, I just thought that
oh yeah.
from a country that
Yeah.
really rarely contributes anything new to the entire Western world, we get tall tales. We get to invent that one, okay?
No, for sure.
A couple ones that are really famous in America. Obvious, this is the one I think many of us, if you grew up in America, you grew up with Johnny Appleseed.
Do you
And
remember the movie? Like the movie that they
the
would play?
cartoon, right?
I think it's like a Disney one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
I
like
think
an
it's Disney.
animated.
Yeah. The Johnny Appleseed cartoon.
Yeah, so Johnny Appleseed, if you never heard of him, if you're living at listening to us from over the Atlantic, or honestly anywhere in the world, Johnny Appleseed was a nurseryman who lived in the 1800s, who introduced apple seeds to large parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and present-day Ontario, as well as the northern counties of present-day West Virginia. He became an American legend while still alive due to his kind and generous ways, his leadership in conservationism, and the symbolic importance he attributed to apples. Like, this was a person who traveled a great distance across the United States during the 1800s. And as a nurseryman, I mean, like, some of these stories about him became tall tales, but at the same time, he did do these things. He's the reason why America has the apple orchards it has today. And a lot of folklore has been attributed to him. And now we have a lot of folklore attributed to the apple, the pentagram in the apple seeds, the seeds being poisonous versus the juice of the apple being sweet. There's lots of ways that the apple has been worked its way into occultism and the magic of herbalism. That's what I was going to say. So this is the one I wanted to talk about because when I was up in Salem, Massachusetts, I thought it was a really, really cool story. Of course, the older towns in the United States that you go to, the more they're going to have probably some more ghost stories, local history, very specific things to their towns. In Salem, near the, I want to say, it's a bar, I can't remember the name of the bar, but before it was the bar that it is now. It used to be back in the 1600s a meeting house, and there was a woman named Sarah, I went on that tour I told you about a few episodes ago, and they stopped in this alleyway and told us the story about the ghost of Sarah that they called the Lady in Blue. And the Lady in Blue has been seen many, many times throughout history, specifically in this place, or at least a vestige or a bluish figure has been seen. But back, I want to say it was either the 16 or early 1700s. They told us the story of a girl named Sarah. They believe she was Irish. She was a indentured servant brought over here to the United States. She was brought over by a captain who paid for her voyage over from Ireland. And she was, I think, about 19 years old. And of course, if you don't know much about indentured servitude, the idea was is someone would pay a large amount for your way, usually to immigrate. And then you would have to work off that time for an average of sometimes around 7 to 9 years. And so he offered her, he fell in love with her. Of course, this old middle-aged man fell in love with this 19-year-old beautiful woman. That was his servant. Talk about an imbalance of power. And he said, "I am willing to wipe away your debt if you marry me." Unbeknownst to him, though, Sarah had already fallen in love with another local man. And she didn't know what to do. She wanted to wipe away her debt. She wanted to be free of this man, but she was already in love. So at the time, captains would go on these very, very long voyages. You know, when you are a captain of a ship, especially when it comes to textiles, that might mean literally getting on a ship over in Salem, Massachusetts, and then taking it all the way over to India and then back again. So you would be gone for sometimes months at a time. So Sarah decided that she was going to go run up to this local meeting house. At the time, I believe above it was also a like a like a boarding house type of a lot of different people were staying there. And the way that they told it was she told her lover, like, "Hey, oh my God, he wants me to marry him. What do I do?" And they said, "Okay, next time he leaves to go on a, I almost said a mission, next time he leaves on the ship to, for a voyage, you and I will get secretly married and we will run off together." And she's like, "Yes, okay." And they convince a priest who was also living in the boarding house at that time to marry them. He was a hopeless romantic and he says, "Okay, I'll do it for you." Mind you, this is all very hush hush because to abscond from what you owe in indentured servitude was like really bad. Like, you, I don't know if you'd survive that level of municipal punishment. So they waited for the day that the captain was going to sail off into a voyage and not be back for months at a time. Sarah put on her beautiful blue dress because at the time, blue was considered to be a wedding dress attire, which is also where you get that old saying, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So she put on her blue dress and they went to the local courthouse, to the meeting house, and they didn't book anything. Nothing was on the actual schedule. So they held it outside next to it, which is where this old alley is now because they built around it. Well, unfortunately, there was no like Weather Channel app back the day. So the
Of
captain,
course.
so the captain set sail. Immediately a storm comes in. What does he do? He turns around. He decides to go to the local pub before he heads home. And it just so happens the pub, yes, because it was the meeting house, used to be a meeting house, 1600s. This is now 1700s. It was a pub downstairs, boarding house upstairs. He comes to the local pub, and what does he see outside of this local pub and boarding house? His girlfriend, Sarah, his indentured servant, Sarah, getting married to this young man. Like, what's he gonna do? So he flips out, goes out there, splits up this wedding in the middle of it. It's literally just the priest, Sarah, and her lover. And he starts beating this dude who's marrying what he considers to be his property. So the captain is beating this guy up. And of course, you know, he's like half the age of the captain. So slowly the captain is starting to kind of, probably not going to win. Well, in a last ditch effort of desperation, he sees an old plank, probably from like a storage box or some sort of like 2x4, picks it up, holds it over his head to bash it down over on the lover's head. When Sarah gets between them, just as he comes crashing down, and it hits her head and kills her right there in the alleyway on her wedding day in her blue dress. They both freak out. This is a transient young man, and he is a well-known captain in the area at the time. The priest, who wasn't even supposed to be marrying them in the first place, they all freaked out. And what do they decide to do? Bury her body in the cellar underneath and tell no one. The captain promised the lover, "I will pay for your way and sail you out of here if you tell no one." The priest, who was already in big trouble for marrying when he probably didn't have the permission from the church to do so, agreed. They buried her body and she was never heard from again. In fact, no one came looking for her because she had no family. The captain sailed away the next day when the storm was clear. He took the lover with him. We don't know what happened to him. We know this story only because when the priest died, he literally left out the rest of his days in the boarding house. He left behind journals, and in those journals, he wrote about the guilt that he felt. I think he died several years later, so it wasn't much longer. They found these journals years later, talking about the murder, talking about the burial, talking about the fact that he was haunted by her ghost for years to come, all the way up until his death. And since then, the haunting of the woman in blue is still around to this day. And if you ever go to that bar, I want to say it's right across from I think it's the Peabody Inn or something. It's right across from the Elizabeth Montgomery statue of Bewitched in the main town square.
Oh,
You can
I think I know where you're talking about, yeah.
still ask about and possibly see the lady in blue. In fact, if you want to be sure you do, you go to the bar. You ask for a lady in blue, and after one, two, or three of those, because it's a specialty cocktail there, I'm sure you'll see her.
That's actually so I don't want to be too much of a pity party. But no, I will anyways. Not to
Do
spoil.
it.
Not to spoil. I love that story. I love it. That's so gorgeous.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here and I was listening to it. I was like, this sounds like something that the restaurant made up.
Oh, really? You think so?
I mean, I don't know for sure, but like, okay, another example. So I'll tell you a story in exchange.
Please.
Something very f famous here, is the Gasparilla Festival, right? Which is a huge festival in the Tampa Bay area. It draws a lot of people. It is to celebrate the pirate Jose Gaspar and his conquest of his love Isabella, and it is to memorialize their love. And I can't remember the exact story. But I mean, it's a whole, I mean, we have a whole month, almost a month long fest. It's not a month long, but it's like 3 days over the course of like a month in February, January or February. And it's a big deal. It's really just an excuse to drink,
Isn't
and dress up
everything?
in really bad pirate costumes. Absolutely, right? And so people have, really looked in to the myth of Jose Gaspar and all of that. And then I'm sitting down with my friend who is a Florida historian, and we're talking about Gaspar. And he's like, "Oh yeah, it was invented by a hotel company in the 1970s to sell more hotels, just to book more rooms, or like the 1940s or something like that."
Oh,
And
interesting.
I was like, "What do you mean? Like this has whole like Wikipedia pages dedicated to it?" And he's like, "Yeah, no. It was, I'm sorry. They were like, definitely invented by hotels to a hotel, I should say, a particular one in the Tampa Bay area to make hotel rooms sell better. And it's been swept up in the zeitgeist. And so people take this very seriously. The pirate was never real. Maybe is based off of an actual person, but like the story is untrue. Obviously, and this idea of like this conquered love is just another way to sell more hotels. And when I heard that, I was gagged. And so it's funny because I'm looking up the woman in blue, and it all comes back to the restaurant, the Rockefellers,
Yeah,
the
the Rockefellers.
Rockefellas.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's Rockefellers.
And so it's like it all comes back. Two, it keeps like that's the first thing you see, the restaurant, the restaurant, the
So it's a
restaurant name.
Hallmark situation, just making up holidays to sell cards.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, those things do happen, and that doesn't mean that, like, I also will say a friend and I decided this past Gasparilla Festival, I was like, well, let's call Gasparilla and see what turns up. I mean, clearly it may not even be a real person, but
I
like,
mean, at this
let's
point, at least it's an egregore. We've all thought about it. We've all been told the story.
yeah, let's see what Demon in a pirate suit turns up. But I mean, we had some interesting results. So it was very interesting nonetheless. So that doesn't make it any less real. That just means that the legend might not be true. I don't know if the legend of the Miss Bluebell or whatever the
Miss
fuck is it,
Sarah.
Miss Sarah, is it isn't real. But I also, want to highlight some other parts of folklore. So folklore has a tendency to, yes, it's caught up in the popular imagination. It tells us a lot about a particular cultural group. It also has the ability to make more pleasant the past, and so that people can almost offload a sense of responsibility. And this is something that we really see in America too. For example, the Hog Island Witch is a local legend around me, in my area where Hog Island is, in Inverness, no, Bushnell, Bushnell, Florida. And it's this little park, state park, and people go there and they, there's reports of, something that terrorizes people's tents at night for the people who camp out there. There's hearing of laughter and shrieking, supposedly. I haven't camped there yet. And I mean, Hog Island is a very interesting place, and I've been there, and I'm like, well, there definitely is, it definitely is a tough spot for sure. But that being said, the history is actually probably a cover-up for deaths that were occurred to either Native Americans or even Black people who had been there. So these say, and then this story kind of gets reported after, like, the revenge of the Hog Island Witch, and it's really too distract from the reality of what's actually happened there. So this is where folklore can become not so great. And it's like, how do we sit here and we grapple with these stories, right? Especially as people who oftentimes draw their magic from these local stories, right? So yeah, just something to keep in mind.
Definitely. I know when I was up in Salem as well, I also learned about like the Giles Corey's curse. If you don't know much about the Salem Witch Trials, one of them is that Giles Corey was one of the accused who and he has a whole backstory. We don't have to get too deep into it, but he was accused and he refused to plead guilty or innocent because he knew once he pleaded, all of his property would be taken from him. And no matter what, even if he was hung or hanged, we don't know how hung he was, even if he was hanged, then I know it's too soon. Too soon. Is it too soon since 19?
No,
Okay, good.
I 1690
92,
something, I
yeah, I
think it's
think it's fine.
fine.
Yeah, so if he was hanged or not, he would still lose all of his property if he pled. So he chose not to, knowing that his property would still pass down to his boys if he died in the process of torture, which he did. They pressed him to death, and his last words documented were, "May you drink
More
blood,
weight.
more weight, and may you drink blood." Which is interesting because the actual ex well the prosecutor at the time, from what I understand and what I was told when I was there, the process was found years later face down at his table, blood pouring from his mouth. And there is a belief in Salem specifically that the Giles Corey curse is responsible for several different things throughout their history, including that the seat of the sheriff, not the prosecutor, the sheriff, that's what it was, the seat of the sheriff would be cursed. And there is a long history of people who were at one point sheriffs of Salem who had issues with lung issues, health issues, sending them into early retirement, not making it to retirement, all the way into the point where they decided to abolish the sheriff's seat in Salem, and instead now they just go with the sheriff of Essex, which
Oh yeah, they don't have an official
sheriff of
police
Salem.
department. Yeah, that's interesting. All the more reason to not become a pig. So
Seriously, I know, right?
wait, wait.
I know, right? I have another one here, the Jersey Devil, which I think is a fun one because it was actually a big inspiration for the Black Tree branch. That's the couple who created, who wrote the book Besom, Sting, and Sword. They have a whole section about the Jersey Devil, which has also an entire backstory to it. I don't want to get too deep into it, but I think that that's really, really interesting. Their backstory, basically, and this is a short little thing. Mother Leeds, it was her 13th child, according to popular folklore. The Jersey Devil originated with a Pine Barrens resident named Jane Leeds, known as Mother Leeds. The legend states that Mother Leeds had 12 children, and after discovering she was pregnant for the 13th time, cursed the child in frustration, declaring that the child would be the devil. I've also heard stories that she, was copulating with the devil, and that's how they created this 13th child, this Jersey Devil.
Same.
It was an, according to one version of the legend, it was born normal, however, transformed into a creature with hooves, a goat's head, bat wings, and a forked tail. Growling and screaming, the child beat everyone with its tail before flying up the chimney and heading into the pines. In some versions of the tale, Mother Leeds was supposedly a witch, and the child's father was the devil himself. Some versions of the legend also state the local clergyman subsequently, thank you. Subsequently attempted to exorcise the creature from the Pine Barrens as well. But to this day, there are still plenty of legends about the Jersey Devil still living in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. There's a couple ones I would just want to throw out as well that are really, really famous. The White Witch of Rose Hall. I believe her name was Annie Hall. Annie, and she, Annie Palmer, that was her name, because I saw this house in Jamaica. This is a large plantation home out in Jamaica that is still doing tours today. It was a very, very tiny little white woman who was ra basically raised and then married a, I believe, a cane farmer that opened a plantation in Jamaica. And she was known to be an absolute horror. I mean, a murderess, an absolute like psychopath little woman. She was known for taking on some of the enslaved people of the plantation as lovers and then torturing and murdering them. She was known for having a little balcony, which you can go to this day. I don't think you can stand on it, but you can see it. It was just big enough for one for her to stand in and watch as things that she was ordering would be carried out. She was known as an absolute like devil on earth. She had three different husbands, and it said that she murdered each and every single one of them. If you take the tour, they will take you into the bedroom and they will literally show you the recreated splatter on the wall where they believe her husband's brains blew out the other side of his ear after she poured hot oil into it while he was sleeping. Each time she married, she gained more fortune, all the way up until the point where the enslaved people of the plantation rose up against her and burned the home down with her still inside. It actually sat as a ruins that was untouched for a long period of time until it was purchased and then restored to its original state. And then I believe the locals of the area worked with a new owner to make it a historical site that now that they can give back to the community. When I went there, it was really, really interesting because a lot of the people that lived there would tell me the fact that the tours stop at 5 because no one goes into the house after 6 to this point in time. There were three different deaths after Annie died that were attributed to the ghost of the White Witch of Rose Hall as well. And I want to go into all that. If you're interested, please Google it. It's a very, very horrific and fascinating story. If you're ever in Jamaica near Montego Bay and you have the opportunity to take the tour, it is a fascinating one. And it is one that I think if you're a horror buff and you like to see awful people get their comeuppance, it's a good one to go check out. Just a couple other ones to think about that I think are very fascinating in the United States. One of them I might consider, people who live in the Appalachian Mountains. Like, you probably already know this, but if you are unaware, the Appalachian Mountains are over 480 million years old. They are older than the existence of trees on this planet. They are carbon dated back to some of the first tectonic plate immersions that caused this mountain ridge. To this day, in the middle of the mountains, you still can find fossils of ancient and extinct sea creatures, which I think is really fascinating. And there are a lot of people who have stories of cryptids and creatures and beings coming out of the Appalachian Mountains. Some of them areas that are still untouched by any settled humans to this day.
The sands of our beaches are made from mountains rising, crumbling.
Thank you for that. So, I think one of the things that is really, really cool about really focusing on grass-fed witchcraft is really getting down to the basics of your neighborhood, your landscape, your state, your city, the rivers you're close to, the plants that grow in your backyard and your neighborhood. I think a lot of us, if you're really looking to grow from the 101, 102 books, and you really want to get into building a craft that is more personalized, more relationship oriented, it's all about getting outside and seeing it yourself, getting involved in it yourself. I myself have written stories out of things that I've been inspired by in my real life, in my local surroundings. And I think that's something that I would definitely encourage a lot more practitioners to do. You've been listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of Crooked Ways. I'm Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light. You can find me on Instagram, Threads, or TikTok for now, at Witch of Southern Light. Please buy my book, Cunning Words, a grimoire of tales and magic, available on Amazon and the Barnes and Noble website. If you are a metaphysical or occult shop or independent bookstore and you would like to carry my book, Cunning Words, please. It is also available on the Ingram Spark catalog. Check out my art on my Redbubble shop, as well as I'm about to actually shut down my Etsy shop. So you have a few more days to check out the PDFs and grimoire pages on my Etsy shop as well.
And I'm Austin Bain X Bramble on Instagram. You can shop me in all my womanly wear. I don't know. You can't shop me. I don't want you to shop me. At BainXBramble.com, where I release my perfumes and other materia magica.
At this point in time, we would love to thank our Tier 3 supporters from our Patreon by name: Jason, Nico, Colby, Callie, Johnny, Jameseth, Jennifer, Cindy, the Witch of Patapsco Forest, John, Giles, Jennifer, Shauna, the Modern Babylon, V, Lisa, Ariella, Keith, Jens, Addity, Tracy, Timothy, Witch Rafa, the Lady Ghost, Seashaw, and of course, Key Archibald. Thank you so much for your support. I truly can't tell you what it means to us to have you be part of the making of our show.